Hello, Gary. It's Rowan from Talbot Tiger Media. How are you?
Good. Don't call me Gary.
I'm sorry, Angry. How's everything?
Well, God bless my mum. I used to say only mum's allowed to call me Gary.
Yep.
But my mum and my aunties and all those. We've lost mum to the dementia. It's an insidious fucking disease.
Oh,
but
look, can I first of all express my my feelings about Liam? I'm most terribly sorry. I can't imagine your pain.
Thank you.
But on a nicer note, you and Mark spent about an hour and a half with myself and my older son in Melbourne some time ago at a hotel there, and he absolutely cherishes that memory, so thank you very much for doing
that. Oh, yeah, I remember that clearly.
Yeah.
Well, see, one of the things, and quite sadly, I mean, which a lot of people, I mean, I would imagine they've forgotten by now, but, you know, he lost one of his kids.
Mm.
In a car accident. She'd only been here, this is some years ago now, but she'd been here, and then she went back to live in England. Like, she came out for a holiday and went back, and then 2 weeks later she was involved, or she was, you know, the victim, if you like, of a car accident, and they lost her. So Mark and I have always had a very special bond, I think, albeit for many, many years from a distance. I mean, we used to sort of, I'd go and see him when he was doing his duet thing. And he featured in a couple of bands with Mick.
Yes.
So I used to go along and just, you know, have a drink and catch up, you know, shoot the shit, so to speak.
Mm, yep.
But since we've been together in the band, it's been a very affectionate band, and a lot of people, I suppose, would be surprised to realise that this is the most cohesive as far as personalities.
Mm.
The other bands were woefully dysfunctional. The people were particularly dysfunctional within their own lives, so they brought that into... And it comes as a surprise, I think, to all but the intimately initiated, the real, real solid fan that knows the ins and outs of the band. But... There were certain lineups where certain members didn't like one another to the point where they wouldn't, you know, there was no social life attached. Whereas some of us, of course, socialised, you know, quite openly and affectionately. But yeah, it was it's a relief to be in a band where everyone really, really, you know, loves one another. And I think, I actually waxed lyrical with, a young lady a while ago doing an interview about the album, and I said, I can actually, one of the things that I love about the album is that it's so loose. I mean, very tightly played, but it's loose in its attitude, which harks back to the early days of the band, the original lineup with Rylan. Sort of, we were a jamming band. We used to do a lot of covers and we would jam, and we had a lot of fun creating that spontaneous music from night to night, we've gone back to doing that, you know, so it's some nights the songs stick, you know, very much to the arrangement, if I feel that that's the way it's, you know, I'm very self-indulgent with the band because, you know, having put the lineup together, not a lineup that sort of came together, but I put the lineup together, so not that I lord over them, I mean, they wouldn't stand that, but, because they're all their own men, but, I'm very much the band leader, so to speak, so if I want to go off on a tangent, they'll just come with me.
Absolutely.
And it's really, really, really fun, and you get glimpses of that, which I forgot, you know, Catherine said to me a couple of weeks ago, she said, well, we're going to have to line up all this press and stuff, and I said, yeah, all right. So, you know, we went through the usual process, if you like, and she wrote a press release and sent it to me and said, what do you think? And to and fro, we changed a few words and a few lines and whatever. And she said, when was the last time you listened? Because she, you know, she's all over it, and she's like a mother to me. She just looks after me really wonderfully. And she said, when was the last time you heard the album? And I said, oh, when the last time I approved the mix for the, you know, for the mastering.
Mm.
And she said, well, go back and have a listen to it, you know, just so you're fresh in your mind, so when you do the interviews, you know, okay. And I went back and I thought, fuck me, what a great album. It's fucking, I just love it. I just love the joy in it, I think, is the way I've described it. And
yeah.
And how, I mean, you know, it's very tight. I mean, they're, you know, the consummate players, all of them. I mean, Jackie's just a fucking monster, and yeah. Mark and him work very tightly together as a rhythm section should.
Hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the two guitar players are arguably two of the best guitar players in the country.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, and Bobby, you know, he's been waiting for the opportunity to be sort of to cut loose, you know, to be the monster that he always was, and who I think it is to a certain degree. I mean, you know, he pretty much was a monster in any band that he's with. I remember seeing Hooks, and I only went and saw this concert because I got free tickets for a start, but, you know, Bob was in the band, and I just thought, Bob, you know, in the Skyhooks, and it was like towards the end of his, you know, tour with them, so to speak,
because
he was in the band for years, as you know,
mm.
but the band was, and it was at Festival Hall, it was at Horden Pavilion.
Horden Pavilion, yes, yep.
And I went with a, you know, like a gang, there was about, you know, there was a bunch of us that went, and it was fucking amazing. I mean, I was such a powerhouse, and I thought, Skyhooks, I'd liked, you know, Sheryl as a person, and I think Freddie Storks is just what a fucking great drummer, what a swinger.
Absolutely.
And and Greg and I have always got along on an intellectual level. we've had sort of many, particularly in the early days, we, but, you know, the two guitar players, I couldn't stand them, you know. And anyway, went and saw him, and I just thought, fuck, you know, he's made him into a rock and roll band, because Bob's one of those kind of people that you look at him and his manner is so laid back, which is why I introduce him on stage as the Mahatma Gandhi of guitar. Because not only does he look a bit like him, but he really is. He's a hippie at heart, but put him behind a guitar, and he turns into some sort of Jekyll and Hyde, you know, which is true, and it should be true of just about anybody that plays in a rock band. But, you know, there's two sides to everyone, two personas, if you like, or two personalities, whatever. There's a duality, you know, which is brings about, you know, the wonderful balance of, you know, the total being, so to speak.
Nice.
But, yeah, and I mean, you know, Mark's always been, you know, an animal at heart. He's always been, I remember seeing him with just after Buster fell apart and Phil joined AC/DC, and then not long after that, Mark came in. And, you know, I always liked his cockiness, and I always liked the fact that he thought, you know, he had a sort of a strut and a swagger about him that he wasn't going to let anyone sort of, like, put it over him, and I loved that about him, you know.
Yeah, most certainly. Most certainly. And, of course, as you mentioned, the contemporary lineup of legends, if I could respectfully reflect on who makes up Rose Tattoo at the moment. As you say, Mark Evans, Bob Spencer, Di Pritchard, Jackie Barnes. I mean, every home in Australia should have at least one copy of the upcoming Outlaws, the legendary raw rock and roll guy.
Amen to that, brother.
Look, but I have to ask you, was there a discussion between you all of the concept of honouring the band's heritage, or does that sort of thing come naturally without discussion? Because you've captured it so beautifully on this album.
I thank you for that. I'm very, very, very grateful, as the others will be. I'll pass it on.
Thank you.
We toyed with the idea early in the piece that for the 40th anniversary, because it was released in 78, for the 40th anniversary, maybe we should do something to commemorate that. And I kind of thought, well, you know, let's wait until 50 and because we didn't realise at that stage that we were going to lose Mick and
yes.
whatever. Anyway, or Peter for that matter. And we thought, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe we should record some of the old set, you know, particularly some of the great covers we used to do, because a lot of them were still on tape somewhere in a box, somewhere, you know, like, but we used to, you know, we did a lot of sort of covers when we first joined Albert's, and as well as our originals. And like we did a version of Street Fighting Man, which originally was going to be our first single because it was, you know, it was very much, a, you know, Street Fighting Man, Rose Tattoo, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And then, of course, during the sessions, George said, look, I think Bad Boy has got potential. It didn't have the signature riff in it. Mick came up with that during a jam session. Wow. And, you know, George chopped it all up into smaller sections to make it an accessible, like a pop song, you know, and like a pop format, so to speak. So, which was when George started to look at the songs and their potentiality, I think that's when, you know, that's when Ian decided that, you know, he didn't want to continue along that line.
Yeah.
Because he was more into the sort of the punk aspect of, you know, like you just play a feel and you don't deviate too much. You have a hooky chorus and, but, you know, it's kind of like a driven droney sort of, like what he went on to do with X. And yet later on after, well, during X period, and but later, the lineup that he did that I most love was a band called Sardine, and he had his then wife playing keyboards on it, Stephanie. And they were a pure pop band, but they were brilliant. And I, to this day, I've been trying to find someone who's, you know, got recordings of, you know, maybe their live performances, because Sardine, what a terrible name for a band. but that's Rylands, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and it was a brilliant pop band. It was just brilliant because, you know, he had... But see, the other thing too with Ian was that he was so mercurial, I think is the right word. But, you know, like one minute he would be, you know, he would be writing like a dozen songs like Snow Queen or, you know, Sweet Love Rock and Roll, pure rockers, you know, like pure three-chord, you know, Johnny Cock, Johnny Be Good type, you know, Chuck Berry, you know, Eddie Cochran sort of stuff. We did things like 20 Flight Rock, and we did sort of things like, we did about half a dozen of Chuck Berry songs. You know, and he'd be totally into that for a while. And then, you know, like a month later or 2 months later, he'd written another couple of songs, which is, he'd kind of like, it was just like, and they spat out lyrics. And then they come to the chorus, and the chorus was quite melodic, but, you know, again, spat out lyrics. And it was kind of like, what I'm illustrating, or what I mean, you know, trying to paint the picture, is that he changed so often, and he was he was bursting with energy, bursting with creativity. And so, you know, that was Rylands. I mean, he was just, and I think in those early days with Albert's, he just thought, you know, maybe this is not the direction he wanted to go in. I mean, obviously, because he left and immediately formed X, which, you know, he had absolutely total control over everything. I mean, the way they played, you know, he wrote all the songs, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that's another thing that he had difficulty with in the early days when I first, joined the band. You know, we apart from covers, we pretty much did all, you know, Ian Ryland's songs. And some of them were sort of really, really good. And some of them were pretty ordinary, you know, but he thought that, you know, look, You know, because, and the other thing too is, I mean, a lot of people don't realise, but we had two Capricorns in the band with Mick and Peter, and two diametrically more opposed people you'd never find. And there was Rylands and I, both Leos, and we're sort of like a week apart, I think, or 2 or 10 days apart in birthday wise, and two more diametrically opposed Leos, you know. Well, there was a lot of similarities in Ian and I, but there was enough differences to... and when I started to, you know, collaborate with him, and I had a style of lyric, which... and it brings me... Oh, this is a wonderful little segue. Brings me to the three bonus tracks. Now, Snow Queen and Sweet Love Rock and Roll are very much Ian Rowland songs. And one of the first songs that I actually collaborated on with him to contribute lyrics was Rosetta.
Yes.
So that's a clever little way. Not that I designed it that way. It just sort of fell into my lap.
Do you remember what the influence was for that track? I mean, you obviously did a brilliant job, but it's no wonder it didn't make it to the album initially. But
you know what? It's one of the great mysteries. One of the great mysteries of life, and I'm glad that you said that, because it's totally in agreement with the way. I couldn't believe when this little jam, this nonsensical, odd little eccentric jam, got mixed into a track. We never even went in and recorded Stuck on You as a track. It was a late night jam, had the chorus, didn't have verses, was going to write some, and I remember George saying, I remember it like it was yesterday, he said, "What's that song?" And I said, "Well, it's not a song, it's an idea," you know, because Pete always had that beautiful little lick, and because, you know, he was experimenting with, you know, like that kind of, not reggae so much, but, you know, different sort of rhythms and stuff. And anyway, you know, Stuck on You like a rose tattoo, and, you know, it was sort of like a, George sort of said, I can hear that, you know, because he said, I can hear you, like the sort of like Tamla Motown influence sort of in your voice. And he said, maybe we could make it into a, you know, like a, like more like a soul song. And he said, anyway, look, put the idea down and we'll think about it. So we did. We went into the studio and I just sang, I mean, you know, Fish Name Sam, please. I can't even remember what the other verse was. I had a coloured parrot, but, you know, nonsensical, you know, just trying to get a melody and a space, you know, like for the verses, but, you know, leaning towards getting to the chorus to be able to sing the chorus, you know. So it came in the next day and, you know, we went on and we were recording other tracks, and by the end of the day we sort of said, at the end of the day we all sat around and listened, you know, to what we recorded the previous day. Always the previous day, because, you know, because it's a day old and they'd mixed it and whatever. And
yeah.
And then he played Stuck on You and I said, yeah, I said, you know, but, you know, I want to write really good verses for it, you know, like having a very romantic idea in mind.
Yeah.
He said, no, the verses are great. The verses are great. It's what makes the chorus work. And I said, yeah, but the chorus is about one thing and the verse is about nothing. And he said, no, the verses are great. They're great. He said, anyway, look, we're just going to put it away for now. And then we actually demoed Rosetta, not in the arrangement that appears on this album.
Mm.
And I pushed for Rosetta because I thought it was such a beautiful song. And it was inspired by a real person. Well, two real persons, both of them women, obviously. I pushed very hard in, you know, as much as you could push George and Harry. I mean, which is like pushing sort of like a 2-ton truck, you know, up a hill. You're not going to get very far is what I'm saying. But George is sort of sitting there and he goes, yeah, no, I like the song. I like the song. And I said, well, you know, I'm hearing it with sort of like maybe a bed of Hammond organ and, you know, sort of acoustic guitars and stuff. And you know, just hearing it sort of a la The Faces, you know.
Mm.
I like the song, lad, he said. I like the song, you know. And that, in other words, that, you know, like, that's the end of the discussion, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't go on with it. And lo and behold, the 10 tracks they picked, which I think Snowy or Sweet Love should have been on the original album, because they're just flat-out rockers, and they're beautiful rockers.
They are indeed. There's a point where Sweet Love Rock and Roll, I think, is going to become a contemporary hit, without doubt.
Mate, I get no argument out of me. I just think, you know, they're great rock and roll songs, and you get sort of songs like, and I like TV. It was a funny little song, and, you know, we used to play it in the early days. It was like 2 minutes long or whatever, and there's another track on the album too. No, I think I like all of them except, I mean, I don't dislike TV, but I kind of thought TV over Sweet Love or Snow Queen. See, I love Snow Queen.
Oh, yes.
You know, I love that song. You know, I really, really love that song. And I love Sweet Love Rock and Roll too. And I actually changed it a bit lyrically for this cut than we used to sing it in the old days. But that's poetic license, I suppose.
Indeed.
But I couldn't believe that either of Snowy or Sweet Love didn't make it onto the cut. And I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely gobsmacked that they chose Stuck on You over Rosetta. And it was one of the few times that I couldn't hold back. And I kind of, you know, when they said, well, okay, this is the track listing. We've mixed all the tracks and come in for a listen. And we went in and there was Stuck on You. And I said, George, Stuck on You was a jam. I mean, if we were going to put it on there, maybe we should have, like, sat down and, like, worked on it as a song. And he said, no, the beauty of it is just the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be. And I thought, end of discussion.
Mm.
But I didn't end the discussion, and I said, well, Rosetta's a much better song. And I remember George, you know, Harry always used to sit on the couch against the back wall facing the desk, right?
Yep.
And George turned around in his chair. He had a swivel chair because he always ran the desk. And he had this way of, he would swivel around and he would clasp his hands behind his head. And he just looked at me and he said, I agree. It's a great song. I love it. But it's not going on the album. And that was the end of the discussion.
Incredible. And yeah. Yes, Snow Queen made it onto the 1990 re-release. But was that a band decision or
that was when they put the compilation. Because it's Snowy's been on a few compilations, whereas Sweet Love hasn't.
No.
And I think there's even a bootleg out there. Well, I know there's a bootleg out there that's got Rosetta on it. Because we used to play it live. There's a Double J live to air that we did. And we did Rosetta.
Wow. Just listening to you speak about it, I mean, it must be a very special and I guess a private thing, so I'm a bit loath to ask about it, but as we're talking about the collaborations and a lot of Ian's writing, I realise that going by the credits with the album, it was very much a band involvement. But Ian,
yes, well,
prominently.
Wasn't.
Hmm.
The point, in actual fact, I mean, you know, obviously Ian gets credits for Bad Boy, even though, I mean, the basis of the song, you know, is there. I mean, lyrically, you know, there was only a couple of lines that we changed or, you know, whatever. But, you know, basically it was his song. But it was kind of like Snowy. It was just a bang 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 a bang. But Mick sat down with, when George heard the potential of a single there, I remember him sitting down with playing guitar and him and Harry jamming with Mick. And then magically Mick just come out with the da 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 da, and he was playing over what George and Harry were playing. So basically just playing the rhythm. And Harry was playing something slightly different, like a counter rhythm, if you like, or a counter melody thing to George. And it, I suppose, in retrospect, and I look back on it, and I'm pretty sure this is what happened, was that Mick was playing along, but it freed him up to look for somewhere to go. And there was only the three of them playing it, and Pete wasn't there.
That's incredible. And I can only imagine the looks on the faces of two of the Easy Beats as this additional dimension came into the song.
Well, as soon as the lick, as soon as the riff, you know, the da 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 ba da ba da da ba da da ba da ba da ba da ba da, as soon as that, I think Mick told me years later it was like a sax line or something that he'd heard, but as soon as that happened, George just went, "That's it. Mick, that's brilliant." He said, "That's it. That's all the song needed." And then he went ahead and chopped it up into verse, chorus, and middle eight, blah, 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 you know, traditional rock format. And the song came alive. And anyway, getting back to one thing I wanted to tell you was that we did this re-recording at Harry's studio, which is a fucking amazing studio. Like, it's a whole floor of an old warehouse, and it's a maze of, you know, sound booths and vocal booths and fucking, there's even got booths where you just put them, you put, there's little booths like about the size of a 6x4 trailer, so to speak.
Oh,
and you just put an amp in there.
Wow.
And it's got a glass wall, and it's got a sponge wall, and it's got a cork wall, and it's got a wooden wall. And you put an amp in there, run the cords all the way through into the studio, and you mic it up in there, and it's like, you know, 200, 300 meters away.
Mm.
But we always did that with Albert's. But anyway, so we're recording, you know, the songs for a couple of days, and Mark Opus, of course, was producing, and he said, about the third or fourth day, he said, "Look, we've got a surprise at lunchtime. We're having some yummies brought in." And we said, "Yeah, okay, whatever." And Harry arrived. And it was just like, blew us all away, because it was like, there was, you know, particularly for Mark and I, there was lots of tears, and, you know, it was just a very emotional experience for Harry to come into the studio, because he's not been well of recent years, and we said, "Oh," I said to him, Harry, you know, I was all teary and everything, and he sat, there's the couch against the wall facing the facing desk, and he sat down, took his position, and I said, Harry, "I'm so thrilled to see you." I said, "What, you know?" He said, "Mate," he said, "I couldn't have my boys in the studio without me being here to fucking, you know, be the guiding hand." And I mean, you know, every now and again, he would, you know, like Mark would turn around, as George used to, swivel around in the chair and look at Harry, and Harry go, "Yeah, that's cool. I like that take." Yeah. And then other times he'd turn around and go, "You know, Di, you really don't need that there, man. Like, just try it without it, you know?" And then Di'd not play what he was playing. Yeah. Like, there was a gap that he'd sort of put something in.
Mm.
And then he'd look at Harry and he'd go, "Fuck, sounds great." And Harry had just sort of, you know, Yeah. He's very Harry, you know. Harry was very, very laid back in those days. But it was just such a thrill having him there, you know.
Absolutely. And, of course, their influence on this album particularly is evident in the story. But if we put into the mix Ted Albert and FIFA Riccobono, I mean, what did they mean for this album and Rose Tattoo at the time?
Sadly, of course, Ted's passed.
Yes.
FIFA's moved on. She's still a consultant with... Well, she was a consultant while they were still a label, but they sold all that up.
Mm.
some years ago, and you know, that was, you know, it was like she said, it was the very, very sad. We were all sad, actually. It was kind of like losing a relative, you know. It was kind of like not just losing Ted, but losing the label. I mean, because Albert's Records is no more. And so she stayed on when they moved into, like, down there at where they were, not Neutral Bay, down from there. But anyway, they have the studio, what they call the Albert Studios. And their influence, Ted's influence, and FIFA's contribution will always be part of the Rose Tat story. Because, and it's the same with, you know, the AC/DC, obviously, but with the Angels and with the Choir Boys and Ted Mulry and, you know, others that they were nurturing or they did nurture later on. I mean, they gave Megan Washington her start. I mean, she started out, her first label was Albert's, and I think she's, you know, a wonderfully eccentric songwriter, but brilliant songwriter and a great singer. And I can understand why, you know, in Australia she didn't go mainstream, so to speak, when
it's
sort of people, you know, like, I don't know, there's some indie acts that have sort of done very well. I mean, I think John Butler Trio is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant songwriter, great performer for a start, but brilliant songwriter and that. But there's other bands kind of that indie ilk that sort of like got more recognition than Megan Washington, and she's sort of like too avant-garde, I think. But brilliant, brilliant talent, amazing songwriter, amazing singer. But the ghosts, if you like, and it's a way of explaining our acknowledgement of the spirituality of people's influences on you and your career and your music. Ted Albert had a wonderful ear, and George would always, and this is testament to Ted's ear, and particularly with singles, but even with the overall album, you know, like Ted would say, well, you know, like, is it finished mixing, George? And George would say, yeah. And he said, well, I want to hear it before it goes for mastering. And he would even make suggestions, George told me years later, and George would go back and remix to get the two comparisons. So that's how much notice they took of Ted. He had an ear for George has often said, I mean, I think he's on record as saying that Ted had an ear for a hit, which he did. And he always, any song that they wanted to release as a single, after all, it was his money. he had to give the nod. Yeah, I can hear that. Yeah, that's going to work, you know. I mean, you know, as much as Albert's under the direction of George and Harry was always going to be like, you know, the great rock and roll label, and we all took great pride in the fact that we, you know, that we were all part of the Albert's family, and, you know, arguably three or four of the great rock bands ever produced by the country were all on Albert's. And but, you know, Ted really had a wonderful ear for what was going to work. And I mean, you know, when he first heard Rose Tattoo, I mean, you know, you get this guy in a three-piece suit, you know, with an impeccable part, you know, in one side. I mean, he was sartorially really elegant. He wore brogue shoes, which won me straight up because I love brogue shoes. But and he was so straight to look at, you know, but he, you know, you turn up at gigs and he'd sort of take his jacket off and he'd have braces on and a crisp white shirt and he'd stand out like a dick on a cow. But he knew his music. His whole family's business was built on music, and he knew music. And apparently he told you know, us later. He said, man, I heard Rose Tattoo. And he said, I heard what I wanted to hear. He said, it was like nothing else I'd ever heard. And he said, but, you know, I knew that, you know, when they came to me and said, look, there's this band that, you know, like everyone's passed on. No one wants to sign because they're just too much trouble. And you know, the way they play is like wild and it's out of control. And you know, because that's what appealed to Malcolm and Bon and Angus and the boys was that...
Mm.
The band had that recklessness about it, and but Ted got it too. So there's a, yeah. You know, this guy that you look at him and you think like Captain Straight Man, which he was. You know, he was a very, very conservative, old family, old money sort of a guy.
Mm.
But he had this wonderful ear for rock and roll.
Absolutely. As I think about these times, and I can't speak to you, Angry, without mentioning Ian Ryland, Pete Wells, Mick Cox, Digger Royal, Geordie Leach, Robin Riley, Lobby Lloyd. I mean, re-recording this album with all this history, all these memories and all this heritage must have taken you right back to being right beside these people. And I hope it's not a silly question, but are they still right beside you when you are playing on stage live?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. More. I mean, obviously more so the ones of the past. But once someone passes, and of course then they go into, you know, you can have an affectionate relationship with people. I mean, you can have a spiritually affectionate relationship with people while they're still alive. And of course you do with your family, your spouse, whatever. Mm. But yeah, that's, you know, those kind of relationships are alive and well. You know, I mean, I love Robin. He's just like... as eccentric as he is, you know, he's one of a kind. I mean, Geordie is probably one of the nicest people I've ever met in my whole life, and just one of the best bass players. I mean, he's a fucking, you know, a freak. But and you know, God, Lobby, God rest his soul. But yeah, I think, you know, whenever we go on stage, the ghosts, if you like, or the spirits.
Mm.
The spirit of those people, the soul of those people is in the songs. They, you know, because when you create rock and roll, when you create anything, it's part of your soul. So you give it, you know, like when you do a painting or a sculpture or you build a house that's got great beauty, it's because you put your heart and soul into it. And that's the difference between, you know, something that's built just for pragmatic reasons or just, you know, like functionality, and something that's built out of passion, you know, whether it be a song or a painting or whatever. And when people see beauty in those things, creations, something that's been created by an inspiration, and then it's no more manifest than music because it's the perfect format because it's all it's sound. But when you go and see a rock band play, I mean, you're getting this visual. You're getting, you know, like oral and as well as, you know, like your senses are saturated. You know, you're seeing and feeling and hearing and it speaks to your inner being, you know, and it really ignites, if it's worthwhile, it'll ignite something, you know, like I'm a huge Pink Floyd fan. I think I may have told you that before, but...
absolutely.
You know, I've been watching... to the point where I'm brought to tears, Gilmour's solos, but even his singing, I mean, it's just heartfelt, it's beautiful. It's because, you know, like I prescribe to the Floyd thing. So on my phone, iPad, whatever, I get all this Pink Floyd stuff, mostly, I mean, obviously live, but... it's just awe-inspiring because there's so much passion in what he does, and it's like... people say, oh, you know, he's a master technician. Yes, he is, because he doesn't play anything that doesn't need to be played, but he doesn't play things that don't need to be played.
Mm.
He plays what needs to be played, you know, and it's like that less is more thing we talk about. It's just like, but, you know, so going back to what we do, as long as there's the passion there, it's tangible. It's not just something you feel. It's not something that excites your inner being. It stirs your heart, but it moves you you know, to react emotionally, physically, and on a higher, finer level, spiritually. And people now have begun to accept that about music, like they did so many years ago when, you know, they had the great composers, and they inspired people spiritually. Well, rock and roll's become that, you know. I mean, and it always was like that. I mean, I listened to the same influences, if you like, that I've always listened to, and I can hear, you know, that quality in the music. And those, you know, the great rock singers and players of the early 50s, they had all that because it was new. It was daredevil shit. You know, they were taking huge. I mean, they thumbed their nose at danger in a sense that, you know, they were going to play music the way black people played it, you know, with gay abandon and sort of like total commitment, passion, and just like, you know, I think one of the great things about those early influences that we did talk about at one stage, and the black influences in my life, I mean, I'm fond of saying I didn't even realise when I was listening to these voices and, you know, these guys playing piano and guitar later on, the blues players, you know, not realising they were actually black, but, you know, slowly but surely, well, quickly actually, you know, not slowly but surely, but very early on in the piece, because you want to know stuff, you know, you found out, well, they're, you know, they're Negroes, they're black people, you know, this is gospel music that came from. But, you know, I was very, very, you know, by that time, you know, because I heard gospel music first, you know, I was listening to Mahalia Jackson and, you know, Bessie and then, you know, of course, you know, my great love of my life, Billy, listening to her, you know, phrase the blues, and it was the fusion of blues and jazz. And whereas Mahalia, I mean, my early sort of recollections of her, which is why I play her to this day, is that, you know, that the gospel influence, the Christian influence, which she was, you know, like, and then you get, you know, you get those wonderful things coming back, you know, I mean, they live within you, so,
oh, yes,
you know, you draw from that person's soul. So in the same way, you know, got a bit flowery there for a minute, but
not at all. I'm so glad you're speaking about it, Angry, because Outlaws, I couldn't help but write today in review that the tracks, My Memories and Doubtless, those for all who were there at the start, and the history of the band has been so perfectly enshrined on this album, which makes me want to ask, you must be so proud of the guys in the contemporary lineup to have captured what they've captured.
Yeah, I am. It brings me to tears. It really does. It brings me to tears. When Catherine said a couple of weeks ago, she said, you know, like, I think, you know, just to refresh your memory, go back and have a listen. And I've got to tell you this, I've gone over, I've succumbed to the wisdom of in-ear monitoring.
Ah.
And I've used it the last couple of years, the last couple of tours in Europe, mainly on the big stages, because it helps you with your pitch, and it also helps you encompass the distance between you and, like, there's 30,000 plus people out there. I've been, you know, over to the dark side, so to speak. I'm besotted. So last year I ordered and received a pair of tailor-made in-ear, you know, they've got like six speakers, minute, obviously. But they're incredible to listen to music, because you hear everything. It's just like, they're just an amazing breakthrough for a singer, because I can go on any stage now. And because, you know, like if we do clubs and the band's loud enough that I can actually hear them, you know, acoustically, so to speak. But, you know, I've got this wonderful clarity in my head. But anyway, listening to recorded stuff, so I listened to the album, and, you know, I'd sort of forgotten a lot about it, like, to tell you the truth, because the last time I listened to it, going back, you know, last year, I can't even remember when it was recorded, but what month, in other words. But I listened to it for a final tick off before it went to mastering.
Yeah.
And the one track that brought me to tears actually was Rosetta. I just thought it was just beautiful. I mean, I don't even remember doing the cut, but it turned out really, really good. But and anyway, having said that, I went back and I was listening to the album like a week and a half ago or whatever it was, with these wonderful in-ear system. And I just thought, wow, I said, these guys are so... And when the idea was put to them, we said, like, what's going to happen is... What could happen is that we could re-record, and I'd like to do that, because I want to add some tracks. Or we could just, as a commemorative thing, we could just do maybe 5 tracks, because there was a couple of other songs which a bit more obscure than Snowy and Sweet Love, and certainly not as in the same vein as Rosetta.
Mm.
But that they were from the same session.
Wow.
And that was their, you know, that was the validity, if you like. That was made them sort of like, well, they could be on the cut. So we could do something that, and release it like an EP, and I wanted the band to jam the way it jams on stage. I wanted to bring that back into the music, because we never got to do that on the first album because it was so structured.
Mm.
And we used to jam a lot as a band in the early days, and like that's why, you know, sometimes Bad Boy was like, you know, 6 minutes long, and you know, Nice Boys, which live is even longer than it is on the cut.
Yes, I noticed that.
we tried to form it, like what Mark said, like, you just can't go in there and jam. He said, well, why not? And he said, well, you know, because, you know, like, it just goes on and on. And he said, it's exciting, but we've got to have a time, you know. Like, so we picked the best bits of the jams that we play most nights, or that they play most nights, and we just consolidated into a jam for the album track. And it's the same with Suicide City and Wally and a few other songs. Always the frantic sort of stuff. Oh, no, that's not quite true. Bad Boy, there's a lot of jamming live, which there is on the album a little bit.
Yeah.
But when we do Scarred in the breakdown, and this was when Robin was in the band, because, you know, it's a Robin Riley song.
Yes.
I used to give him a passage, like a solo in that breakdown part, and he would play a sweet, beautiful passage, you know, like a solo. And it just gave him that moment to sort of, like, bring the beauty out of such a brutal song.
Mm.
You know, Fell in Love for Sweet Dog, yeah, because it came out of his solo into... Fell in Love for Keeps One Time, you know, and Rock and Roll, you know, pulled me away from, which it's done on a handful of occasions, like, well, particularly 2 or 3 that were, I don't think Rock and Roll was the culprit that, you know, because I've got to take some responsibility, but, you know, I wasn't about to give up what I am or who I am or what I do. And, you know, that impacted. There's no doubt that impacts on relationships. But anyway, having said that.
Most certainly. And, of course, what's most important is that all Australians get off the couch and catch Rose Tattoo under the Southern Stars, as it were, to celebrate not only this album, but the contemporary lineup of Rock and Roll Outlaws that is Rose Tattoo. Angry, every time you perform, it's your heart and soul that we see on stage. How does it feel for you to connect with an Aussie audience, even overseas an Aussie audience, and to see them celebrating Rose Tattoo history and heritage along with you?
Well, in recent days, it's taken on a deeper meaning, because it's helping, you know, it's part of my healing process.
Mm.
But there's no doubt that... you know, your home, you know, is just that in every respect. So, you know, when we're out doing, you know, there's not too many tours like of the sort of the caliber that we're doing with the Stone Temple Pilots, but you know, every gig is just, you know, it's a gratification that you can't, and I think everyone understands this in a compassionate sense. You can't get that. I mean, it's home. It's your people. It's got to be special. It's got to be different. It's got to be, you know, just. It's just special, and that's the only word I can think about. You know, it's just the fact that we, after that 10-year break, and we're back and, you know, playing in front of, and you know, we played in up on the Gold Coast, I think it was, and there was a mum and dad, and they had a son, and the mum and dad were sort of like a bit younger than me. And their son, who was, I think, you know, like in, must have been in his, like, 30s maybe, getting towards 40s, I don't know, but, you know, well-kept, you know, well, good-looking bloke. And he had his two children, both teenagers, you know, like a girl and a boy. And they were sort of like, their eyes were like saucers, and they were just like, you know, a friend knew these people and said, you know, can they just come back and get some photos? Yeah, yeah, you know, like after the gig, you know, we're sort of like anybody's. You know, they came back in and they were sort of just, the two kids were standing there, were just going like, and the bloke, the kid said, like, I just, you know, I'm a player, man, I play guitar. And so he was just, you know, all over Bob and Di. It was like, it was lovely to see, you know, and...
Yeah.
And he just said, oh, I had no idea. He said, oh, you know, Dad's always played your records. He said, but I had no idea what it was, you know. And he was talking about what you're talking about, was that visual, oral, you know, that experience. So you've got to see it all. You know, you've got to be standing there right in front.
Absolutely.
To see it happen, yeah.
And if they're brave enough front and centre to pass you along a Eureka Stockade flag.
I thought that's what you said. You know, I mean, let's not get into the politics of it, but, you know, in the old days, we used to always fly the flags at the back of the stage. Now, of course, we've got our backdrops and stuff.
Yep.
And... people used to say, oh, you know, blah, 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 support the unions. I said, the Eureka Stockade was, I mean, you know, yes, Gallipoli was, you know, the blooding, if you like, but, I mean, Eureka Stockade, to me, was the start, the spark that produced the great Australian identity, because it was not Australians, but they were living in Australia. They were British people, predominantly.
Mm.
But they were standing against their own authority, which is, you know, British rule, which was... Because in those days, you know, there wasn't the Australian flag, it was just the Union Jack. And
yeah.
they struck the stars and bars, what we now know as the Southern Cross flag, in defiance, and they wanted their own flag. And I've always identified very, very strongly with... that stance, you know, like, you know, and I've written it into songs, you know, it's written in a few songs with, we stand for freedom and liberty, and it's like the oath, you know, we swear by the Southern Cross to truly stand by each other and defend our freedoms and our liberty, you know, our rights and our freedoms, our liberty, and I've always thought that was the spark that ignited and it burned and it grew and it burned brighter and all the way up to, you know, those horrible days, weeks of on the Gallipoli Peninsula where Australia really became the manifestation of from, you know, the first time that they dropped prisoners off and, you know, from then to becoming a real nation, like that was. I mean, you know, federation, yes, of course, because it was, you know, the rules and regulations were worked out, so to speak.
Mm.
But you know, becoming something is it requires pain and then growth, and that's why, you know, like, we won't get into the politics of it. That's why I object so much to this whole, you know, like, we have to apologise for how we started as a nation. No, we don't. You know, there is always loss. There's always pain to gain. Mm. So we gained, what we gained was far more than we should be dwelling on. I don't think that the I totally agree that, which is why I've always supported the Aboriginal people in their quest for not so much equality, but for at least equality, if you like, but
yes,
at least to be treated, you know, with justice and compassion and love and not be used as a political football and whatever, you know. But that you know, as you know only too well, they're my personal views. But you know, you can't live in what happened. You've got to live to today, you know, and you learn from what happened. And that's as an individual, you know, you go to therapy. They don't say, oh, well, you know, you were abused as a kid, so you can use that as a crutch to be dysfunctional for the rest of your life. They don't tell you that. They say, okay, deal with the pain, go back to where it happened, deal with the pain, leave it there, and come back to the present, you know, as whole and healed and someone who can... you know, make something out of, you know, pain. Because as I say, you know, pain is our greatest teacher, which it is. And it's like, I just wish, you know, we could, go back to those, the manifestation of what I'm talking about was, you know, like things like Eureka and Gallipoli and other, you know, any other, war is an amazing manifestation of, at the same time, of gross stupidity and greed and all those bad things. But it's what it brings out is in the best of people. It's kind of like what's happened with the fires. I mean, I think one of the things that came out of the fires that as Australia realised, well, we're still Australian. We still look after our own. We still rally. When the shit hits the fan, we can unite and be strong and purposeful and positive and grow from the experience, which is exactly what's going to happen.
While you're talking about this, I'm looking at the title of the album, Blood Brothers, and can't help but think how much strength gives people the ability to take strength forward into their futures, as you say, rather than reflecting too much on the past.
Yeah, mate, I've got, you know, when I put this lineup together, when they decided to become a band and we did become a band, I always had an eye for, you know, where could we go? Where do we go next with Rose Tats? I was ready, as I said to you last time, up until about 3 years ago, I was ready to sort of just like, I didn't think anyone could sort of convince me to go back on stage as the singer of Rose Tattoo, but... life has, I mean, I was ready to retire and, you know, go and grow rocks and trees and in some, you know, little country town. But, you know, life obviously had something else in mind for me. And
well and truly.
You know, my life in the last couple of years has changed dramatically. I've had to embrace a whole new life in one sense.
Indeed.
And at my age, that's a very illuminating experience, but it's also a liberating experience because it's not just, you know, there's life in the old dog yet, but, I mean, it's more than that. It means that there's more to accomplish and life isn't done with me yet. And I'm grateful for that, you know. I mean, it's knocked me around like I've never been knocked around before, but, you know, going back to Mum and her strength of faith, I mean... I'll always get up and I'll always come back and I'll always say, okay, well, that's happened, you know, what's next? And I'm, you know, like I'm so looking forward to writing songs. We've started to collect ideas and that's the way we write. I like the guitar players to come up with their own ideas. And the great thing about it is that Bobby and Di, even though they mesh so well together on stage. I mean, as two players and as two heads, that you know, like they're the ideas that they're giving me are like chalk and cheese.
Yeah,
you know,
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so that's like kind of getting this really different thing from Bob, and a, you know, like, you know, really different thing from Di. So it's going to be exciting to, you know, between now and next year to put together a collection of songs that we think, you know, are good enough to be an album.
Absolutely. Well, between Tats Live in Brunswick and the 10th anniversary of Blood Brothers and now moving into Outlaws, they're such exciting times. I remember a few times ago we spoke, you hadn't performed live in 8 years. I can't see that ever happening again now, Angry.
Well, I don't think we've got 8 years for a start, so I'm going to... No, I can't either. I think this band's got some life in it. And I think, in you know, like, after the next album, I think that'll be a fairly rootsy, bluesy, but, you know, with some good, you know, big, big, chunky sort of anthemic sort of songs on it. And I think if we get, you know, when we get to, or if do we get to another one after that, that'll be a much more, you know, mellow, back to the blues, rootsy sort of a thing. And I think that we've got, you know, as a playing outfit, I think we've got at least another 4 or 5 years, so that's probably maybe 2 more albums. And, you know, I think, you know, by that stage I'll be in my late 70s, and I think, you know, maybe not physically able, but certainly maybe defined enough to still want to... I mean, like, you know, like, I think it's positively indecent, really, that a 72-year-old gets up in front of a heavy rock band even these days. I mean, I think it's kind of like, you know, really? I mean, you silly old bugger, shouldn't you be doing something else? Well, the point is, no.
You and Lemmy Kilmister will celebrate until the end.
We talked about it, you know, the last day, the last time that we were together, I remember that we were talking about just that very thing. And he was sort of saying to me, he said, you know what, the next time I come out and tour, he said, we should do that track that he and I and Biff recorded. I can't even remember the name of it, but Saxon actually played it when we were on the ship. Saxon yeah. played it. But
It'll come to me, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, I can't. Well, I recorded the bloody song and I can't remember what it, but it was, you know, it's just sort of like a schlock rock thing, you know, hail, hail, rock, you know, whatever. And but, you know, it turned out to be not a bad song.
Indeed.
And Lem sort of said to me, he said, well, the next time I'm out, you know, you brush up on the song and we'll do it. And I said, yeah, okay. And we talked about our health, and I asked him, and he said, yeah, I had a bit of a scare a while ago, but I'm fine now. I'm, you know, I'm back on the, he said, I'm, you know, he's off the piss, you know, as much as he could. I mean, he was drinking very, very little last time I saw him.
Mm.
And he said, you know, I'm watching my diet. And I said, don't turn on into a vegan on me. And he went, no, no, no chance of that. We had a bit of a laugh, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, the ravages of time. And, you know, I mean, he looked so good, you know, because he'd sort of, he'd knocked, you know, a lot of drinking on the head, the hard drinking, and particularly the powders. The powders went years ago.
Mm.
And, you know, he was very positive and he was very optimistic about the future. And, you know, we were all together in one room, the two bands, and we were just sort of having a drink and having a bit of a talk. And, you know, they were sort of talking about, you know, mounting new tours into America and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, so he was very positive. I mean, you know, I mean, it was probably the best part of a year later that he died, but maybe not even as long as that. But I remember he had this very positive attitude towards, like, you know, and I said, well, I never really, you know, because I think I'd just turned 70 then, or maybe just was going to. And I said to him, I said, I remember the first time I met him was at Dingwalls in London. And the first thing he did was give me a big line of speed. And after that, we were just 1,000 miles an hour drinking bourbon and talking shit. And it seems so long ago. Anyway.
Indeed. But got a rock to stay alive.
Yeah, but we had it. We both had a very positive attitude towards, well, you know, like you know, like when you were young, you think, oh, I'm not going to be singing rock and roll at 60. Well, why not?
Indeed. Why ever not?
Yeah.
That was the track. Angry, I've got a rock to stay alive.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's the song.
But look, Angry, you've given me so much time today. I hope you'll forgive me for being such a selfish bastard. Because
no, it's always a pleasure, brother. It's always a pleasure.
But thank you very much. I'll let you go for this evening. I can't wait to catch up again.
Righto.
Please pass on our regards to all of the guys, and
thank
we'll
you.
Look forward to seeing you out there on the road.
No whackers.
Thanks very much, Angry.
No whackers, bro. Bye.
Bye-bye.